Okay, so here we are at the end. I'm surprised. So one of the sort of sneaky thing I'm most proud of was I signed up from Iran to be the summary speaker right after the first day, before he knew what was coming. So of course, I've always known Mehran's a great teacher, because I was his PhD student, but I didn't know how good a student he is. See, as all of you have seen, he's been to most number of lectures and taken notes meticulously, and sometimes even see him juggling with a biology dictionary. But then after a while, I guess you don't need it anymore. not only that, Mehran put what he learned into practice and did his own fitness experiment and just had a baby girl over last weekend that still managed to give us to this talk. One last thing is that aside from spreading his genes, he also managed to spread his memes. So in addition to me, he was involved in a program, Hao Li, his former graduate student, was chairing the section on genomics in March, and Barbara Jessel is here, is with us, and another student, Nadine, who was with us most of the time, seriously started doing some protein for him. So before he knows it, he might become one of the Luca of this new field of statistical biophysics.
Okay, thank you, Terry. So one of the things I learned here is that you have to put that thing on.
Yeah.
and don't forget to turn it on again after the break.
Yeah.
And it'll put it on. Right. Another thing is that if you want to interact with biophysicists, you have to use PowerPoint and slides now. I certainly don't know how to use PowerPoint, and I didn't even have my usual way of preparing transparencies here, so I decided to experiment with preparing things on the web, so let's see how that works. Okay, so the past 5 months have been quite an interesting experience for me. I thought, like the usual ITP program, I'll bring in some of my papers to read and some work to do, and I'll attend some talks every now and then, and talk to my friends. And so that's when Terry asked me to do the summary. I said, okay, how hard can it be? Of course, what happened was that we have had a long list of speakers, something like 4 hours per day going 5 days a week. And so by my count, there were something of the order of 170, 180 talks. So my next strategy for the summary was I could basically read the titles of all of these, and it will take the 2 hours, so we'll be done. But I found very soon that with all these many talks in this field that was new for me, there was really not much point in trying to do anything else. So I sort of became a student and tried to learn as much as possible. And so first of all, I want to express my thanks and appreciations to all my teachers here, many biologists who came and went through and patiently explained what they were doing and didn't mind getting all kinds of strange questions from physicists. And it was certainly a great experience, and anything that I say that is wrong is my fault and not due to them. And secondly, I'd like to thank at this point not only the speakers but the organizers of this meeting. It has been very different from all the other ITP meetings that I've attended, and a lot of it is thanks to the organizers, in particular Terry, who had managed somehow to get all of these biologists who are doing important things to come and talk to us. So I'd like to, at this point, thank the speakers and ask you to join me in thanking Terry, Walter, Luca, Gary, and Chao for their organization. Okay, so what I'm going to we're talking about is really from the perspective of somebody who's not an expert in this field. As I said, I've been learning things over the past few months, so I can tell you a little bit about what I've learned about problems of modern biology. And what I would like to focus and try to select among all of these diverse materials that we've had, aspects of it that have quantitative nature, and then ask whether physicists, and in particular statistical physicists, are suited to go after these problems and think about them. After all, there are large groups of statisticians, etc., who can do a lot of these things. And it was interesting during the meeting, especially at the beginning, we had all of these biologists coming in, and they were excited to see so many people here, and they wanted us to help them. But most of the time, what they wanted was basically somebody to go and write some computer code for them and do some similarity, etc. And to me, that was not sufficiently interesting. I think there is sort of much more meat beyond that than just writing code that does similarity checks. And so I try to mention some of the things that I found interesting. So the first few transparencies are basically a review of what we learned at the beginning, and in particular, Gary Stormo had a nice set of tutorials in which he sort of gave us the basics of the elements of this field of how information is used and transmitted by biological polymers. And at the lowest level, of course, it is encoded in the sequence of the four possible nucleic acids that we have either in DNA, RNA, or the 20 different amino acids in proteins. And this aspect of the informational content of a sequence is like looking at alphabet and trying to decipher the meaning of that. And so maybe linguistics and statisticians are very well suited and have the tools for doing that. At the next level, we go from this information in the sequence to the physical three-dimensional structure of the molecules. And at this stage, I think physicists can make contributions, because what is determining the shapes of these objects, their interactions, is some combination of chemistry and physics. Now, of course, some of the structures, such as the double helix for the DNA, it's clear what its purpose is. It's really very well suited for duplication, and we also heard a lot about structure and self-assembly of RNA and protein folding, and I mentioned those things a little bit later on. And sort of going along the way that the program was developed, at the next stage, the question was regarding networks. So the next part is how you take the information that you have at the molecular level, structure, etc., and get to assembling things that act like cells, organisms, ecologies. What are the networks that are involved? What are the individual modules? And these are, again, questions where aspects of systems analysis, complexity, etc., arise. And the final stages of the meeting were sort of focused on evolution, which is, of course, how all of the information in the sequence structure hierarchies has to be interpreted, because in some sense, none of these sequences, certainly they are not random. They may or may not be the optimal structures or sequences for the function that they are serving, but one thing that is certain is that they all are originating from some common ancestry. And so that historical origin is something that is always superimposed on all of the other aspects of this structure. Now, what Gary Stormo and a lot of other people told us was the central dogma of molecular biology, which is that the three types of molecules that come up again and again, DNA, RNA, and protein, are related in this fashion, that DNA replicates and, of course, is used to transcribe RNA, which is the message that goes outside the nucleus and is then translated to give us the proteins. But this is the zeroth order structure, and one has to build upon that. And let's go back to thinking about the sequence. And of course, the most important sequence is to think about the sequence of the DNA, because proteins, etc., all are ultimately derived from that. And one of the figures that we saw quite often was describing this fact that we have an exponential growth of the number of DNA pieces and bit pairs that have been sequenced. And so this huge amount of data that is growing exponentially needs to be somehow understood. Now, when you look at the DNA, you can ask what kinds of information it carries, and the information carried by the sequence, presumably at the lowest level, is used to encode for the proteins, and there are these gene coding regions of DNA. But then there are also lots of other places which are not involved in coding for genes. And one of the words that was used was junk DNA. But of course, that junk DNA serves various purposes. And one of the important parts of it is that there are regulatory regions, promoters, enhancers, etc., that tell you whether or not some particular gene should be transcribed or not. And so when you look at the types of information that the DNA carries, one of the simplest aspects, again, is that you have the genes. You need to know whether you want to go on one strand or the other. And then there are these promoters, enhancers, etc., that tell you whether or not you should start transcribing one region or the other. And in the case of eukaryotes and the human genome, even the genes are broken into parts that are the introns and the exons, and the exons have to be spliced together, and they can be done in a number of different ways. So you have alternative ways of putting these things together, taking advantage of combinatorics, etc. So that's another part of the information that has to be carried through. Okay, so when we look at this sequence, can we tell which letters are doing what? Can we at the lowest level say where the genes are located and which part is this other junk, for example? Now, the thing that helps you immediately for identifying genes is that you have to code for the 20 different amino acids, and you do that using the triplet codon rule. So basically, triplets of base pairs will tell you which amino acids you should select. And you have a table like this that includes some stop elements that tells you, okay, we've come to the end of the protein, you have to stop. And this triplet nature is certainly something that can be taken advantage of. So in order to find whether some sequence is coding for a gene, well, one of the simplest tests is whether or not you have these stop codons appearing or not. And so open reading frames are regions where these stop codons cannot occur. And if you find regions that statistically should have, if these things were randomly distributed, stop codons, and they don't, that's a good sort of clue that they could be part of a gene. Another thing, because of this triplet nature, is that there should be some kind of information if you were to Fourier transform things at the level of triplets. And we had a couple of talks about how to identify regions of DNA that are genes. One of them was by Ramaswamy, who has this program GeneScan that allows you to identify regions of DNA where the genes are located by looking for evidence of frequency one-third peaks when you do a Fourier transform of the sequence, and says that that's a very good and accurate way of identifying potential genes. Another talk that we had on this problem was by Borodovsky, and he's using yet another statistical model, which is called the hidden Markov model, in which you give some probability that you go from one base pair to the next base pair to the next base pair, etc., and use the information that you gather from statistics of existing genes that you know, and that these are not one-step hidden Markov processes. That's the thing that he uses, but things that involve either three steps or up to six steps, and using that information, you can try to parse the DNA and identify regions that you think are genes. And he says that the specificity and sensitivity of this method is quite high, numbers that are around the 95%. Okay? So it is interesting that although you would have said that this is really a problem of statistics, well, part of it is selection, that the two methods of gene finding that I have indicated are coming from people who spoke at these workshops, and they probably came here because they were physicists at some stage in their career. But nonetheless, I find it interesting that physicists and not statisticians have contributed to this important thing that you need to analyze the information content of the DNA. And the same is true about one of the other approaches to another problem. So in addition to carrying out the information for the coding regions, we said that there are parts of the DNA where you have the signals about whether or not you should start transcribing some particular gene and in which direction, etc. And those regulatory elements do not have this triplet character to them. So how do you identify them? The common methods, one of them is by comparing different genomes from different species, let's say, and saying that regions that have some function, be it regulatory or something else, should have been conserved more than other parts of the DNA. So these comparative methods are quite often used, and by comparing regions that are conserved across different species, you can try to identify where the regulatory elements are. But another method that was again developed by a number of physicists, CGR, Hawley, and Hawley spoke about it briefly, is completely statistical in character. So again, given some dictionary of characters, their method is to try to segment it into words and find the probabilities of different words, and by that method to figure out which combinations of letters are significant. And he called this method, Hawley called this Moby Dick, because the way that they tested it was to take the text of Moby Dick, remove all of the spaces, and try to give it to the computer program and see whether it would identify the words. And if you look at some of the transparencies that follow this dictionary method, you can see that it is all calculations of partition functions. It involves these derivatives of free energies that we like in statistical mechanics, recursion relations for calculating partition functions, Green's functions, etc. So it's all very nice statistical methods that can be used to address this problem. Okay. The next part of the program, the question was, so let's suppose that you've identified regions that you think are coding for proteins in the DNA. Can you say what kind of proteins they are coding for and what the function of those things is? So you would like to find or identify families of genes and their function, and in this way to annotate the genome. And there again, there are lots of statistical tools that are present. And we had at the beginning of the program some very nice talks from important statisticians in the field, Alshur and Dembo. And one of the simplest problems that you can have is that you can try to see whether two sequences that you obtain from, say, two different species are similar, and so you try to align them. And the simplest form of this alignment is where you don't allow any gaps, you try to just match one letter to another and try to come up with some kind of a score for how some particular sequence and another sequence in some particular alignment are close to each other. And one of the things that kept coming up again and again in the first part was the Gumbel distribution, which is again something that comes up again in statistics and statistical mechanics involving extreme value probability distributions. And so given that you align two things and you have some particular score, this can tell you how significant it is that you have such a score. But while this part, the gapped alignment, was certainly done by a statistician, it is interesting that while they knew and had a lot of results about cases where you allow gaps, that the people who can say again something useful analytically about this this problem of gapped alignments are statistical physicists, because as Terry Hua and Ralph Bunshaw showed, this problem in which you have one sequence and you try to match it to another one, but you allow for deletions and insertions between the two, can be mapped to the problem of a directed polymer finding its optimal configuration in some random space. And while the transfer matrix method for solving this problem in polynomial time was known to the statisticians, there are various aspects of the statistics of it that one can obtain analytically using methods that are known to statistical physicists and not necessarily to statisticians. And again, even in this part of the problem where we have just a question of statistics, evolution plays a very important role, because in order to find some kind of a score for similarity between the sequences, you have to have some idea of what the probability is that you go from one to the other as a result of evolution, because you are comparing across species. And alternatively, you can use these similarities to construct trees that tell you how the species originated. Now, from sequence to structure. So the simplest view of the DNA structure is you have this double helix, the two strands go across each other, and you have the Watson-Crick pairs. And this is, again, something that is very easy to open up, and then you have a template for duplicating the molecule. Now, even at this very simple level, there are some questions that are certainly of interest to physicists, if not necessarily to biologists, involving the structure of this molecule and how it, say, melts, because you have a competition between energetic factors that would like to have the double helix, and if it opens up, you have lots of entropy gain. And indeed, because of the entropy gain, if you heat it up around 80 degrees, it denatures and it opens up. And we had quite a few talks discussing the nature of this transition, whether it's continuous or discontinuous. Associated ways of denaturing the molecule, rather than heating up, you can pull on it and try to unzip it. And David Lubensky gave a talk on that. And another very interesting aspect of this molecule is the energetics that you have for twisting it. And we had some talks about the elasticity and the topological aspects of this double-stranded DNA. And I think that's a problem that is actually both of all of these things are things that statistical physicists have contributed a lot, and there's lots of more interesting problems to look at. The next molecule that you can look at is the RNA, where you, rather than having a double strand, you have a single strand, so it doesn't have a partner to bind to, but it can bind to itself, again forming either Watson-Crick pairs or hydrogen bonds. And just saying that what nucleic acid on RNA binds to another one specifies for you the secondary structure. And one of the things that we learned was that this secondary structure, if we say that there are no pseudonauts in the chain, can be obtained in polynomial time using what is essentially the Hartree equation. And this was apparently first pointed out by Degen many years ago, and again is something that is known to the people in this field, but it is interesting that a physical model, a physical method, the Hartree approach, can go so far in this direction. I understand that one of the outcomes of this meeting was that Henri Orland and Tony Z have now come up with a way of going a little bit further, including planar graphs that go beyond these diagrams that have no pseudonauts. Other things that we learned are what happens if you take one of these RNAs that has formed some twisted secondary structure and you try to pull on it. And there were experimental talks on this. And again, this secondary structure can be calculated in the presence of force, and you can have comparison between theory and experiments. And I think generally in all of these problems related to structure, pulling on the molecule at the two ends is something that can hopefully give you a lot of information. We heard that also about in the context of DNA, and in this case on RNA also. Now, for the case of proteins, what we heard was that the main reason that they form structures is hydrophobicity. And basically you can group the amino acids into hydrophobic and hydrophilic types, and at the zeroth order you can fold this thing by having all of the hydrophobic ones try to come to the center so that they are not exposed to the water that is outside. But other elements that one can identify in the secondary structure of the proteins, and this is again from Gary Stormo, are either these helices or the beta sheets that then come together and form some three-dimensional structure, which is the fold of this molecule. And again, it was good that for this problem there was something that as a statistical physicist I could identify with some kind of an Ising model for the problem, if you like. And the simplest type of model that we heard about, let's say here from Ken Dill, was again reducing the complexity of the protein and the different types of amino acids to just whether they're hydrophobic or polar, and assigning an energy which is obtained just as the number of bonds that are H hydrophobic. And so this is simple kind of Ising-like model. This lattice model has been studied a lot, and a lot of the involvement of physicists in this problem of protein folding has come from trying to understand these simple models. But what we heard was that in order to get NIH funding, you have to go to more realistic models of protein folding. So Shakhnovich, who is certainly one of the people who started thinking about lattice models, was going to do all atom simulations, etc., to figure out what basically here you would like to have the amino acids and represent them in a more, say, continuous fashion and include the pair interactions, etc., which was all very useful, except that we had this very interesting talk from Eitan Domani on the limitation of this part of this type of approach, where he showed that if you reduce the problem to basically just looking at pairwise interactions between your elements, there was no choice of pairwise interactions that could lead to the proper folding of a particular protein. So that suggests that, again, maybe even these realistic models of protein folding, they should not try to be too ambitious, because limiting things to pairwise contacts, etc., has its limitations.
Is this claim universally accepted or controversial still?
It's a proof. But it's a proof for a particular protein called cambrin. So this is something that I think has 44 amino acids. And what he showed was that you take this structure of 44 amino acids, write all possible pairwise interactions that you can think of, and for each one of these pairwise interactions that you can think of, you will find a structure that is the minimum energy, and it's different always from what you know is the structure of cambrin. And so it's a difficult thing to prove, but for this particular protein, it's a proof. Okay, so this was basically just a survey of what we saw. Now I'd like to go to some of my own thoughts. And in particular, sitting through the talks on protein and RNA folding, it seems that they are distinct communities, but maybe there are some important similarities between the two, and if there's some more crosstalk and interaction between the two communities, it would be useful. First of all, the size of the two communities is indicated by this transparency by Tinoco, who said that if you look at the cell, there is this much DNA and there's this much RNA, and then the proteins, you could, there are lots of them, but they are diverse. But the knowledge of the structure is, we know certainly a lot about DNA at the level of the double helix. There's lots of people who indeed in this program talked about proteins, and we had fewer talks about RNA, despite the fact that at least for its secondary structure, we have these nice polynomial algorithms. So what are some potential similarities and distinctions between the two types of structures? First of all, in both cases, what you have is you know the sequence and you know that you have to come to some particular structure. What is common in this mapping is that there are many, many more sequences than there are possible structures. So this is a many-to-one mapping that you have from this sequence space, which is hard to draw, but you can imagine sort of indicating all possible sequences, that is, say, 4 to the n in the case of RNA, and figuring out the, let's say, secondary structures that you can have. And for the case of RNA, we heard from Schuster and Fontana, certainly the number of sequences that you have is 4 to the n, the number of secondary structures that you can form, so this sort of forgets about the additional folding of this structure, is something like 1.8 to the power of n, where n is the number of elements that you have. So certainly there are many more of these. And then the question is, if we draw the sequence space as this square, although it's highly multidimensional, can we make a mapping from sequence space to shape space and find out what the characteristics of that are? And the image that Schuster and Fontana gave us was that this is like a very random mapping, that is, if you have one point in the sequence space that goes to some particular structure, a neighboring point in which, let's say, you just change one of the elements of the sequence, goes to something that is completely different. So the picture that they had was that you have these regions in sequence space that go to different structure that are like fingers that are percolating through each other. And another interesting thing that they came up with is the idea of these regions being neutral networks in which basically evolution can proceed without changing the structure. And so first of all, many more sequences than structures, as I mentioned, and then these extended neutral networks in sequence space. Now, we had pretty much the same model or the same the same type of question asked by people who were thinking about protein folding, such as Chow Tang, Goldstein. And let's introduce the question in the context of yet another Ising-like model of protein folding, which is the solvation model. So here, you basically reduce the protein sequence to whether you have polar elements or hydrophobic elements. So the whole complexity of amino acids is reduced to a binary 1-0 structure. And then the key point is that, say, the zeros that are polar want to be on the outside, whereas the ones that are hydrophobic wants to be inside once you have folded the structure. And then so you can have an encoding of the structure in which you go, you say whether as you go along the chain you are on the outside or on the inside. So that again, outside, inside is a binary choice, and you can have a coding of the structure that is also in terms of zeros and ones. And the preference of the hydrophobics to be inside and the polars to be outside can be expressed by the solvation model, which is basically the dot product of the binary sequence representing the structure and the binary sequence representing the protein. And this can be thought of as a metric that wants to make these two sequences as close to each, as possible to each other. Because of that, they come up with something that, if it was a regular space, would be the analog of the Voronoi construction. So the dots represents all possible sequences, and the ones that are circled are structures, again, these sequences of 1-0s that can be interpreted as inside-outside. And again, the key point being that there are many more possible sequences than structures. So structures are basically some dilute set of points in this space. And then in order to find which set of sequences go to a particular structure, you just have to find for a particular sequence which structure is closest to it. So this Voronoi construction then breaks off the space into regions that are coding for different structures. And here the regions are in some sense compact. So the mapping that you have from sequence space to structure space is interpreted in two different fashions for thinking about RNA and for thinking about proteins. And one thing that I would like to be sure about is, first of all, whether this difference in the pictures that are presented is real, or maybe it is just because of the lack of our understanding of the geometry of this high-dimensional space. But I think there are statistical tests like the number of neighbors, etc., that can help us to see whether these two are really different or the same. And then if they are indeed different, maybe there is a very simple explanation for that, in that at the lowest level, if we sort of reduce the problem to just zeros or ones, for the case of the protein, the zeros want to be together. Let's say they are the hydrophobic ones, and the ones want to be together. Whereas if we reduce the RNA problem to zeros and ones representing the purines or pyrimidines that want to alternatively base pair, then the attractive pairing that we have is between ones and zeros. So in some sense, the proteins have ferromagnetic type of coupling, whereas the RNA, in this very simplified version, has an anti-ferromagnetic coupling. And then the question is whether that could potentially describe the difference that we have between a picture in which you have compact regions and a picture that you have interpenetrating fingers. So rather than wanting to go to something that is closest, maybe for the case of RNA, you want to be as far apart as possible. Okay? Actually, this mapping that we have between sequence space and structure space comes up in different types of things, like Boyce Schramm introduced the model that was describing the evolution of regions on the DNA sequence where a promoter binds. And so here he had basically, again, a mapping between sequences that were recognized by the protein and some particular ideal sequence that that protein was designed for. And so again, same elements appeared in his talk also, and I think that one of the areas that maybe we can try to think about, and certainly I'm going to think about, is the types of mappings that are possible from sequence space to structure space. Another set of questions that were asked in the context of protein foldings. And protein foldings at some stage started with the idea that there are these many possible sequences and there are fewer structures. And so why is it that most of the sequences don't exist? Maybe they just don't fold properly. So foldability is the idea that there are some sequences that are special and have nice thermodynamic stability criterion. Later on, there is an alternative picture, which is designability, that it is actually some structures that are very easy to obtain because there are large regions of the sequence space, all of which go to some particular structure. And so the structures that we see are the ones that are most designable. I think one thing that is missing and would be a way to think about it a little bit further is how evolution comes into play. Because we had a very nice talk only a few weeks ago by Eugene Koonin, where he tried to find basically the evolution of structures, and he could trace back by looking at domains of proteins, etc., which particular structures he thought existed right at the beginning and which ones were inverted later on. And that's something, this sort of evolution of structures and their complexity, something that I did not see in any of these lattice models that people here were talking about. So it would be very nice to see whether one can come up with some kind of a lattice model that can give some kind of a temporal order for which structures are coming first, which ones coming later in terms of either designability, foldability, etc. One thing that I think would be necessary in order to have something like that is to be able to work with sequences that have variable length. Again, most of the models that I saw people working on analytically were things that had some fixed length, but in order to allow for the diversity and evolution of structures, we probably need to be able to go to models in which the length of the chain itself is variable. One other thing that was emphasized a lot in the context of proteins and less in the context of RNA is the dynamics and basically how proteins fold. And one of the things that a lot of the speakers mentioned was that proteins actually fold quite fast. They need to be able to do that, and there are some fast-folding proteins who do so quite effectively. Now, one thing that I didn't quite get from listening to the talks, and again, I later on asked Henri, and he wasn't sure either, is as you increase the length of the protein, do we have any idea of how the time scale for the folding scales with the number, with the length of the protein? And the reason I'm confused is because we had two different pictures. One of them, talked about by, say, Finkelstein, is that the limiting process is some kind of a nucleation. So once you have this globule, that's the protein to be, in order to get to its properly folded state, there is some critical folding nucleus that should form. And once that forms, you have to cross the barrier, and then everything goes nicely, and the activation process needed to go across that barrier is related to the surface tension and should grow like n to the 2/3. So the prediction of this type of model is that the time scales, the log of the time scale should be like n to the 2/3 because it's an activated process. We also saw a lot of models in which the important feature was topology. So the idea was that there is no distinct barrier, there's kind of a funnel, but there's still lots of different structures have to be explored in order to find the bottom of that funnel. And So again, you start with some kind of a globular structure and you want to end up at the bottom of the funnel like this. And a model that was used a lot is called the go-like dynamics, in which the important element is at the beginning you say that finally in the end, say this particular amino acid has to be next to this one. So you designate all possible contacts that have to be formed in the native state. And the dynamics that is imposed is that if by random fluctuations two atoms that belong to that particular final contact come close to each other, you make that bond and you keep it. And so then the natural coordinate that tells you about the progress of the reaction is the number of native contacts that are formed. And here in this model, there is no particular nuclear barrier. It's a matter of topology. And what you find is that in these kinds of models, you have a characteristic power law dependence for the time. So that's something that at least for me is unclear, whether the time scales involved in this protein folding are log time goes like a power or it's a power law itself. And but I think that this topological aspect of the problem, that there are lots of different possible pathways and you have to form the appropriate contacts and then you start going down the funnel, is actually quite interesting to explore in the context of the RNA secondary structure. And there may be ways of also doing experiments and confronting theory and experiments a little bit better. Just from another theoretical aspects, one picture that was used quite often is that of a reaction coordinate. So in chemistry, you say you have one initial state here, you have a final state here, and you sort of draw a line, and then there's some kind of energy barrier, and you have to go from here to here. And what is at the top there, you call the transition state. But I mean, here you are dealing with a polymer, you have lots and lots of different states to explore, is reducing the problem to a one-dimensional state space ever appropriate? And I think for the case of proteins, that's probably a hard question to answer. But there are cases such as involving RNA and DNA where there is a natural reaction coordinate, and one can probably even figure out the appropriate dynamics as a function of that. So an example of that would be to make a hairpin in an RNA. So you form the head, and then the length of the hairpin has to get increased. And so you can look at the natural reaction coordinate, which is the length of that hairpin. Or another example that we saw involves translocation. You have a polymer, let's say a DNA in the virus has to go inside the cell, and how far it has gone to is another possible reaction coordinate. And I think one can develop for these simple polymeric models cases where you can think about the dynamics of this reaction coordinate more carefully and come up with some answers. Another thing that was kind of intriguing to me was the interplay of sequence and structure. It is typically we talked about the importance of structure for proteins, a little bit less, but certainly it is there for RNA. And then the sort of zeroth order picture is that for DNA, it's the double helix and there is no further structure to think about. But in fact, the DNA has to serve multiple purposes. And this is an analogy to a hard disk of a computer by Shapiro. And in addition to things that are sequence related, there are signals that tell you where and how the DNA should be replicated and distributed among the daughter cells, which parts of it are gene coding, and there the error rate is much less than, and there's much more damage repair than parts that are not coding. And so there are lots and lots of different signals that should be there. And they are all probably, or some of them are probably contained in the three-dimensional structure that is formed by the DNA in the cell with the help of proteins called histones. So rather than thinking about the DNA for this more sophisticated way of thinking of it as a hard disk, rather than thinking of it as a line and a sequence, one should realize that it is folded in a very specific way, first around the histones, and then the histones come together in a particular fashion, forming this fiber, and then this fiber loops around, and you have a very complicated structure that is formed in the three-dimensional sense. And I think it would be very interesting to think about the physical forces that shape this three-dimensional structure and how they are related to various functions that this three-dimensional structure must perform. At the lowest level, once you have packed the DNA around the histones, one of the things that happens is that there are the regions of the DNA that are wrapped around the histones. And in fact, if this was a better three-dimensional picture, you would see that they are actually pretty much buried within the histone. So it is not so easy for them to be accessed by proteins and other things that have to perform functions of on the DNA. So one possibility is that the regions that are accessed are really the ones that are between histones. But there is, we heard about various types of experimental evidence that that's not really the case. And actually, if there's any part of the DNA that needs to be accessed, there are ways of accessing it. But we didn't have a talk about this at the ITP, but I was at some other meeting and I heard a talk by Jonathan Widom, who has done a lot of work on this problem. And he could show, for example, that there are cases where there are regulatory elements that are within one of the regions that is wrapped in the histone. And the ones that are closest to the end are easiest to access. And then once they have been accessed, the next one becomes easier, etc. And so by wrapping them in a specific way around a particular histone, you could have a way of deciding which region you can start to activate, transcribe, etc. Now, one question that, occurred to me, and for which there is apparently no clear answer, is whether there is the histones wrap around the piece of DNA that's about 146 base pairs. And it seems that they are more or less fixed. So what is the signal that tells you whether you should be wrapping around some particular 146 base pairs and not another? Now, this is an informatic signal that is present at some larger level than the ones that people have been identifying, that is basically 5 to 10 base pairs. So the question is whether one could sort of develop statistical methods that can figure out whether there are signals at this range of number of base pairs. I think most of the methods that I talked to you so far work at shorter of the order of, say, 10 base pair levels. And then there are other questions that one can ask, whether there are signals at this level, not necessarily for histone positioning, but other things, like when the DNA needs to be replicated prior to cell division, there are these cohesions who come and basically attach themselves to some particular pieces of DNA. And we heard about them from Joe DeRisi, and he said that we could find, by biological methods, various regions where this would occur. So the positions where the cohesions would go on the DNA were very specific, but apparently no bioinformatic signal is known for them. So if I just give you the sequence, you can't, at this point in time, tell where these important regions are. And presumably there are other elements that go into this overall structure of the protein, where you form loops, and by basically forming loops, you could also put regions of the genome inside or outside and make them more or less accessible, and maybe that would be a good way of making different types of cell types. And that is something, again, that I heard some little bits and pieces during the meeting, but at least I don't know the answer about it. So what I'm getting at here is that there could be information to be extracted from the interplay of the sequence, the bioinformatic signals, and the three-dimensional structure. So this again is a question where physicists could get involved and play a role, in particular because it seems that forces and energetics that are important for this large scale structure are things that maybe we have some experience with, like electrostatics. The proteins are usually oppositely charged to the DNA, and that's why they are attracted to it. And that's the case for the histone, and then you form these complexes, and these complexes have also electrostatics interactions between them. So certainly the electrostatics is an important part of the problem. Bending rigidities are important, and they go into the question of whether the proteins can bind specifically or non-specifically. So I think that trying to put all of these elements together, bioinformatics, electrostatics, bending rigidity, etc., to predict something about the overall three-dimensional structure of the genome is a direction that one could go further with. So it's 11 o'clock, and maybe we can take a break as usual, and then I have about three or four of these transparencies that are more on the larger scale. Basically, one of the tools that is used is clustering. So what you can do is you can have different tissues put on these chips from different conditions, let's say patients who have some disease or not, and then try to correlate the data about the gene expression that you have among the different samples. So this becomes a problem of clustering the data. And we had some nice talks about the statistical issues of having some bunch of points and trying to group them into clusters and how they would be relevant to a problem such as this. And I think, again, that's sort of interesting issue that all the clustering algorithms that I could think of or were presented, they certainly, I mean, it's an ill-defined problem. So for each clustering algorithm, you can certainly come up with examples where it is likely to fail. So question is, do we know enough about the network structures, etc., to be sure that the type of clustering algorithm that we are using is not giving us false information, or whether or not we can use some background information about how things are working as networks to design better clustering algorithms. Of course, again, the primary problem here is whether or not you can find whether there is a disease in the tissue or not, and existing algorithms that we heard about seem to be working very well. In addition to these approaches where you get information about all things, all of the different proteins, etc., and then you try to extract correlations, there are approaches that are more sort of specific, in which you can ask whether some particular gene or regulatory element or whatever is involved in a process that you are interested in. And we heard quite a few talks from the group that started with Stan Leibler, taking advantage of the green fluorescent protein for reporting various functions that are taking place in the cell, and let's say how we can use that kind of information to figure out the order in which the different genes are expressed in the synthesis of the flagella module. They went even so far, this group, that they can, by incorporating different genes, they can make an artificial clock, they call the repressilator, in which there are three regulatory elements, each one of them represses the other, and the combination of them as a function of time works in such a way that you get a signal that is periodic. And at one hand, they could show that this is actually the signal that you get in the fluorescence of the cells, and at the other level, they could write these mathematical equations, differential equations, three-coupled equations, and solve them and show that you could, under what circumstances, get this periodicity, etc. So that was a very nice confrontation of model and experiment. And the types of models that we heard in for networks, and I guess this is backwards, is again, so far along those lines where you have you specify a set of connectivities and a set of dynamics, how things evolve as a function of time. It seemed to me that there was too much freedom in the design of the models, and you could basically get a lot of things by tweaking around with your parameters. And so the question of how universal these models and how useful they are, I'd like to sort of see further explored. But this is a direction that apparently will be further explored at the ITP. Boris Schreiman is organizing a workshop on networks in about a year and a half, I understand. So I asked him what he was going to cover. And some of the things that he mentioned are gene expression pathways, signal transduction, etc., that we already saw in the current workshop. And so I asked him why it was important for physicists to think about these problems. And he said, first of all, there is a huge amount of data that is going to become available about different circuits and networks, etc. And so there's quantitative information, and maybe In his words, physicists as simplifiers are good bunch of people who try to make models for what is going on. Okay? Now, the very last month and a half, we sort of went deeper into the origin of things, and I guess one of the advantage of being at ITP is that in addition to your program, you are exposed to other colloquia, etc., and we had a number of talks about the origin of the universe and it's sort of the similarity between the origin of life and the origin of the universe kind of strikes you when you are sitting in some of these colloquium. In both of those cases, you try to sort of work backward in time and extract information about the Big Bang or some other origin. And again, there could be some event horizons that prevent you from finding out what was going on right at the beginning, etc. But this question of the origin of life, presumably one can trace its steps, first of all, to the origin of organic molecules, which as explained by this slide in Lancet, could be potentially explained by basically this experiment of Miller and Urey, in which they had a spark chamber in which organic molecules could be formed out of very basic things such as water, methane, etc. And then the interesting question that Lancet posed was what are the first self-replicating units? So these are the organic molecules, but what are the units that are capable of replicating? And the standard picture is that the first molecules that achieved this were RNA, but following ideas of Dyson, Lancet was presenting a potential alternative scenario in which it is lipids. And in the case of the world starting with RNA, the information content would be in the sequence, and then the duplication of the sequence has high level of fidelity, whereas in the alternative proposal in which you had lipids, they would basically form these balls of lipids, and it was the composition of the different types of lipids that you have that would carry the information. But in this case, their replication is very easy. You just break the thing in two and you have more or less the same composition, although the fidelity is not as good. And it's an interesting model. I don't know how far one can go with that. So once you have this self-replicating unit, the next level of complexity is when you have RNAs and proteins and the associations of the two of them together. And so here we had interesting talks about the origin and order of the different amino acids, and Trifonov suggested that this is the consensus order of amino acids, with glycine coming first. And one of the consequences of this is that glycine can be used as a clock to sort of rank where the different separations of the different branches occur as you go down towards the earliest, go backwards in the evolutionary tree, because presumably in the beginning there were mostly glycine and the number has to be reduced or can be reduced as you evolve further and further on. The next aspect of this origin that was explored a lot is the connection with the association of proteins and nucleic acids. What is the reason for the particular type of triplet code that we have? And we had nice talks on this topic by Landweber, and so the easy way out is that it is chance and you don't have to think about it, but maybe if you look at the percentage of different amino acids and how they should be coded, etc., and you try to find the best code to achieve the mapping that you want, you come up with this particular triplet code, and there's that apparently has a lot of support. You can show that in some sense the code is optimal with respect to mutations, etc., preserving the compositions of or percentages of amino acids and things like that. But the solution that Landweber suggested from experiments was that there is, in fact, again here, this question of the interplay of structure of sequence that could be important, in that she had evidence that you can form RNAs that bind some particular proteins and identify what is special about the sequence of those RNAs, and you find a lot of similarities and repeats of the codon regimes that associate that RNA and the codons that associate the RNA and that protein. So that's a nice potential physical explanation. Again, from comparing the different sequences, we can try to go back and reconstruct what was happening at the level of the last universal common ancestor of all of the life forms that we see currently. And a very nice talk about that was given by Eugene Koonin a couple of weeks ago. And unfortunately, his talk and many others is not on the website, so I had to go to his website. So my hope is that this talk, among the others that are missing, will be restored so that the website is complete. But anyway, so one of the things that he finds, basically his method is to look at protein structures and use them to construct trees to figure out what particular structural motifs were present and are common to all, and therefore potentially present right at the beginning. And in this way, to reconstruct the last universal common ancestor. And one of the conclusions was that this ancestor encoded a complex repertoire of diverse proteins, but probably did not have modern type system for DNA replication. So this is sort of evidence in favor of RNA being the precursor before DNA came into play. So at this point, I was amused with how far we had traveled from the beginning of the program towards the end, where we had this conclusion. Because at the beginning, where we had the introductory talks by Gary Stormo, etc., where the information transfer with DNA to RNA to protein was presented, almost invariably the newcomer physicist in the program would ask, why is the RNA step necessary? Why can't you go directly from DNA to protein? And by the time we got to this stage of Koonin's talk, question was, why is DNA necessary? okay, then you can continue to go towards diversification, speciation, etc., and questions that we have been asking. Now, if you notice my sort of, this is almost my last slide, what I have for the second half of the talk, for the second half of the program, is considerably less than what I had for the first half. And there are a number of reasons for that. One of them is that there was a lot of, I guess probably more than usual, changes in personnel across the program. And most of the people who were here at the beginning are gone, and people that are here did not know what was going on at the beginning. So I thought maybe summarizing that part was useful. Secondly, I think that for the parts that involve evolution, there is already a very sort of sophisticated quantitative audience, and people who gave talk over the past month are certainly physicists, statistical physicists, who certainly know the field much better than I, and they've contributed a lot of quantitative models. There are certainly questions and interesting problems, let's say with phylogenetic trees, as to whether or not one can associate certainties and probabilities and look at different trees and not just the best tree. And we heard about some Monte Carlo methods that would do sampling, but it wasn't, let's say, clear whether those methods would converge to a particular probability distribution. So there are certainly questions in tree construction that one can try to answer. Sankoff gave a number of very interesting statistical questions that would come up in trying to figure out the how the ordering of different genes changes as a function of evolution and different types of mutational effects, how they would affect that. Certainly genetic drift is very similar to diffusion type problems, and we had talks related to that. Herbie Levine told us about some simplified selection models and how discreteness effects are important and large n limits should be taken with care. The issue of sympatric speciation, we saw a number of models that had things similar with symmetry breaking. Derrida talked about similarities in genealogical trees, memes, life expectancy, etc. All of these we heard some very sophisticated mathematical models. And so I think in this area, there is no lack of statistical physicists who are much more mathematically sophisticated and aware of the field than I. But one of the other reasons that I didn't really focus so much on this part was that I was, as Terry pointed out, engaged in an experiment in population biology of my own. And so that birth of my daughter last week certainly changed the amount of time that I had to spend on this. Finally, going from one fledgling to another, so we have this community of statistical biophysicists who have attended this program. And what do we do next with this community? Where do we go? And what are the things that we can... Sorry, too many of us, I guess. Well, I guess the main need is to somehow maintain interactions among the different people. And one of the issues is, well, where should we submit papers so we all read each other's papers? And for condensed matter and statistical mechanics, say, the archives at Los Alamos are very useful. And they do, in fact, have a portion that is on biophysics somewhere down here. Where is it? Biological physics. And so just for amusement, if you look at this, you can see that this is nowhere near CondMath in its extensivity. And so there are, say, gaps from June 14 to, or June 13 to June 6th until Terry submits a paper, and there's otherwise not much activity. So maybe this is a resource to be taken advantage of. And someplace that, or I think the part that is bad about it is the classification of this under general physics. And maybe if it was under CondMath or statistical physics, there would be more participation. And I also got this email from Paul Martin, and I didn't realize that it was from Paul Martin until Terry pointed out to me, so a number of other people here probably got the same email and may have junked it. But apparently the suggestion is that the Proceedings of National Academy of Science is one place where interface of statistical physics and biology could submit papers, and that's a possibility. It would be very nice if there is some kind of a communal web page where we can have information about recent publications, events, etc. The next step, of course, is training of future participants, and I certainly would like to take some of this material and go and teach a course at MIT to graduate students and sort of some elements of biophysics. I know I talked to a number of other people who are doing the same, like Nigel Goldenfeld, and it would be good if we have some collection of possible courses and how to proceed with them. Further meetings, there's one in Aspen this summer on enzymatic networks organized by Schreiman, who's presumably doing a precursor to the ITP workshop that he will be doing later on, and I mentioned. I'm going to stay on and learn another type of network. The next ITP program is on neural networks, and that has a lot of certainly biophysics and a lot of statistical mechanicians already working in that field. And this is the year of biophysics at ITP. In addition to these two programs that I mentioned, there's more traditional soft condensed matter program, which as you can hopefully see, has also a biopolymer aspect to it. And you may think that all of these things, networks, etc., exhaust different types of statistical biophysics. I think there is room for yet another one that is more, say, single molecule biophysics and forces, protein motors, and such things that has another a lot of other interesting aspects to it. And so, again, all of this, it has been very important to have the participation of the different people at ITP, and in particular, I guess we should thank the staff who've done a wonderful job, and Terry was going to call them at 11:45, and it's 11:50, so I'm 5 minutes late. And monkey, kitchen duty. If you've no explanations needed.
It was said that this is one of the sloppiest programs in terms of coffee spilling.
Okay. All right, so so since they are not here, we can go back to my last link and once more thank the organizers who made all of this possible.
So, as all of us know by now, Mera Lenzing had a baby on Friday, and all of us are very proud of it because I think it's a rare event to have a virtual baby. So we give you our very best wishes and send you our congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much, Barbara. Thank you. I'll take this to my wife. Thank you again.
At this point, of course, it's very special to thank again our organizers. It's a very non-trivial sequence of steps from the idea of getting this or that part of biology into the program to actually have biology speak to the strange functions of physics and come here. And I think our organizers, in Harry in particular, have done a tremendous job. I guess the ramification and consequences and the outcome of this cannot even be gauged at the moment, but it will become more and more visible over the coming years. And I think in our discussions we have emphasized a lot of the teaching and specificities of physics and biology thinking. But I think, as Mehran's talk has also made beautifully clear, there are many more uniting links that unite us physicists to these exciting trends in biology. So I guess it's very much in the spirit of our organizers and of this meeting to not even worry whether we call it physics or biology, but just do some interesting science and then come back and discuss it again.
Okay, I just found a few notes before we all leave. First I want to also thank the section chairs, the six of some of them, they're really able to the day to day work, and lots and lots of work. Otherwise, you know, the session won't work. Okay, so let's give them a big hand. And so about the issue about how to keep this community, this is going, I mean, Ron mentioned this archive, Masalam archive, and I've been in touch with Paul Gainsborough to try to see whether we can have a sort of a biological figure sort of on its own, and there's a number of people make the suggestion, and it's very likely that we will have a sort of a section biological figure, like in this matter, and with the sort of receptors. Sort of feel free to request this, but it would be good that if we all send our frequency, then we would keep sort of keep track of what each other is doing. I intend to maintain this what page we have. Chase down the talks that are still missing, and that's I'm too tired to do anything more than that. But if anybody of you wants to take this web page and return it to some forum like the down there for the economists, feel free to do so. About email. A number of you asked me for a list of emails for participants. So I think everyone has a list, and I also have a list. So if you want to do something constructive, feel free to ask me. But I don't want to sort of just post to the public because there's so much junk mail going around in danger of people sharing. If you're doing a conference or whatever, just want to keep track of people, by now, all of you know much more about the subject than I did a year ago when I was learning from Walter and Gary to prepare for this program. So hopefully somebody will take lead and take the leaders to the next level. All right. Thank you all for coming. I'm one big bottle of champagne. I'd like to get a zip.